My guest today on this Roundhouse Making Space podcast is Jack Rook, the multi-award-winning comedian, writer, and poet. Well, we'll come to the poet bit in you a bit later. He grew up in Watford, but attended projects and courses in the Roundhouse, remained connected today as a Roundhouse ambassador and commissioner of the Young Creatives Commission. He won 2 BAFTAs, a Sky Arts Award, an Attitude Award. Okay, I'll stop there, otherwise we'll be here for the rest of the day. Multi-award-winning is right. He became a famous name for creating and writing Big Boys for Channel 4, which is semi-autobiographical. My earliest memory of you, Jack, goes back to about, I suppose, 2011 or 12, when you were part of the Roundhouse Poetry Collective, and it has been a joy to see your career flourish in the way that it has. Jack, it is a wonderful delight to be talking with you today. So if it's okay, I'm going to jump into a few questions straight away.
Yeah.
Let's start by going right back to when you were little. What was little Jack like?
I've never been little.
Nor have I, that's true.
I've always been large. Young Jack was, I don't know really. I think I was sort of quite a annoying child, actually, to be quite honest with you. I used to spill drinks really easily. I was always falling over, I was always scraping my knee. I'm quite sort of gangly and definitely a bit dyspraxic, and I really loved the Spice Girls and Thomas the Tank Engine and the Vicar of Dibley. 3 cultural pillars, I think, of Great Britain.
Did, when you're growing up, did your family introduce you to, apart from what's going on TV, did they ever go out to kind of Christmas pantomimes, or did you go to the Watford Palace Theatre, or did you go to see shows? Were you involved in the kind of theatre comedy world from an early age?
Yes and no, really. It's interesting because my dad was a black cab driver, and back in the day, I feel like, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, cultural institutions, the theatres, the West End, galleries, museums, blah, 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 would give free tickets to black cab drivers because they were seen to, they were Google, you know? If you arrived as a tourist in London, and when pre-Google, you would ask a black cab driver, what's good? Where's good to eat? Where's good to go? What's good to see? So he'd often get like free tickets for stuff. And that was probably the only like kind of cultural engagement I really did outside of school trips. I remember once we went to see a play about Tommy Cooper's death, and yeah, I was too young to understand what was going on. We also went to see Little Britain Live. So, I mean, there you go, really. Two huge theatre hits. But that was it, really. I never really went to galleries or exhibits or anything. That's all something I sort of found a bit later on in life. But I do remember going to a couple of pantos as a early child. But yeah, that's kind of it. I was a sitcom boy. Like, I think TV was always the entry point for anything. I used to love music videos, sitcoms, and I used to really love watching the news. I would always be like, oh, we've got to watch the news. Now I hate watching the news.
I joined the club. I mean, you know, the Tommy Cooper. It's funny you mentioned Tommy Cooper because I was staying with my grandparents in Bexhill. On the news came the message that Tommy Cooper had just died on stage. And all I remember, in my memory, we were watching him live on TV, which I don't think is true. Just like that. And falls over, and that was it. You know, just like that, he'd gone. But he'd always been part of my consciousness, but I think I'd made that consciousness up. Can you remember, were you a kind of performer as a kid? Did you try and do a stand on a box and perform a comedy thing to your parents and family?
I think I did. I think me and my nieces and nephews, my niece and nephew are sort of same age as me. We were definitely always trying to put on shows or plays or like playing in the garden, something that like we'd made up. So yeah, definitely. I think there was a lot of like inventiveness. And I was like, really, I was really lucky. I had like a really lovely childhood. And if I wanted to go on a school trip, I could go on a school trip. And things were available to me in that sense. So I felt really, you know, that there was definitely a sense that, like, I was allowed to be creative. My auntie always says, my auntie just came to the BAFTAs with me a couple of weeks ago, and it was so nice because she has definitely, my auntie Jenny has definitely been probably the most, like, culture pushing member of the family. We're called the posh ones because, like, we'll, you know, go to a local gallery or something like that, or Jenny will sometimes listen to Radio 4. And she's like a plaster painter decorator even at like 73, so she's not overly in a creative job, but she's such a creative person. So I think so nice she was with me at the BAFTAs when I won, and I was like, oh, I'm really glad that she was my guest, because she definitely put a lot of creative investment into me.
I was going to ask you about that. So Auntie Jenny was your big kind of champion, encourager, and yeah. I suppose, were you, from that very early age, were you trying to tell stories? Can you remember what the stories were you're trying to tell in your back garden?
Or it would have been definitely like pop stars related. We were probably all just pretending to be like different members of Steps or something. You know, when I was sort of growing up as a kid, it was the time where, like, all the pop bands also had a TV show. It's like S Club 7 had a TV, like, so maybe like four or five series of a TV show about themselves. The Spice Girls had Spice World the movie. Like, people were constantly acting or playing in the make-believe type thing. So, yeah, but I think I was always, like, writing stories or coming up with things. It's definitely, I suppose, an inquisitive part of my nature from a young age, but I didn't really... I never thought, oh, I want to be a writer. It was really never... overly like a part of my thought process. If anything, maybe I thought I would way more likely to be like an actor or a performer. And I suppose I am to a certain extent, but definitely feel more like a writer, which I often think maybe comes out of a want to sort of tell a story more than like inhabit something else type thing. And that might not always be the case. Maybe in like 10 years time, I'll be like, I just want to act or just perform or be in other people's sort of stories. But I've definitely always been writing about my own life for such a long time, which has kind of come to an end now, which is quite nice, really.
Well, I'm going to come to that in a bit, actually. But I wanted to work out how that young Jack in his happy little childhood, doing little shows, Auntie Jenny taking you out, encouraging you, you know, all of that lovely picture. How did you end up coming to the Roundhouse, which is, you know, quite a way away from growing up in Watford?
Yeah, I have a feeling that what happened was I was at school. I was maybe in year 11 or year 12, I think. Part of my business A-level, AS-level coursework was you had to set up your own business venture for young people. And I decided that I was going to set up a music festival that was going to be for like in Casterbury Park in Watford. That was going to be like a, and this was all hypothetical because I never have secured the finances to actually do it, but you were sort of being marked on like how realistic your business plan was. And I just wanted it to be a sort of festival for young people, played by young people in the local park. And I got work experience from a guy called Rob DeBank, DJ on Radio 1, and who ran Best of All. And there used to be this thing called BBC Switch, whereby you could like go to like talks as young people with different creatives, and there was like a Q&A section. And anyway, at the end, I just said to him, like, I've come up with this idea. I'm actually thinking about doing it. And he was like, well, come and do some work experience. Come and do it. And so I was 16, and I went to the Isle of Wight by myself, and I was his assistant's assistant and did this work experience placement. And it was amazing. It would have been, yeah, about 16 years ago now. It was there that one of the producers was also doing a lot of stuff at the Roundhouse and was like, you should apply to do a creative project here. And I think I was thinking about studying journalism if I went to uni. And I'd never really thought about going to uni, but I knew that journalism was something I was really interested in. So I signed up and I did the multimedia journalism project at the Roundhouse. which was a magazine called Red Top Magazine.
I remember it so well, yeah, yeah.
And so I did that, and then through that, I started interviewing different poets, and I interviewed the poet Maria Ferguson, and through meeting her, she was like, well, why don't you do some poetry as well? Like, why don't you write in a different medium? And I'd always thought, I really like the difference between sort of like serious writing and really creative writing. And I think there's a little part of me that's like, maybe I could have been a journalist or a copywriter or whatever, but I sort of enjoyed the more creative narrative type stuff.
So can you remember the first poem that you wrote?
I can. It was called Lasagna. And it was about all the different lasagnas that people would bring to my mum's house in the weeks after my dad died. And it was like a sort of comedy poem about getting like, of being sick of everyone dropping off lasagnas. And then me and my mum sort of rating them all from 1 to 10 and being quite judgmental about people's use of bechamel sauce or whatever. But that was the first one that I wrote on the Roundhouse Poetry Collective. And it was amazing. Like, I loved that experience so much. It will forever be like one of the biggest sort of defining moments of my life, because, you know, I still speak to Maria Ferguson and Izzy Brooks, who was on that course, and then your other podcast guest, Cecilia Knapp, I met through that project, and we've sort of been best pals ever since. And, you know, I'm godfather to her son. Like, that's where you look at the impact of the Roundhouses in a really amazing way, because not only are you forging like young creatives together, but you're also forging young people who then become friends and family and peers and things like that. So it was definitely, I think, one of the best things I ever did, even though I probably now identify as a recovering spoken word artist, because I was never as good as the others. My poems were always just like funny lists. I think my poems were always just a precursor to just doing comedy, which I think is quite a valid way in, and a way that I think a lot of like poets and satirists and humorists, like, there is something very funny about the rhythm of words and dialogue, which is why I actually think I've become a screenwriter, because I really believe in that scripts are essentially just jotting down like the amazing things people audibly say. Like, it's really about, for me, it's about how it exists and the tone and the intonation and the rhythm of everything. Like, I'm quite meticulous about dialogue writing, and I think that definitely comes from my spoken word past.
Well, I'm glad it had some positive impact for you. Looking back at you in those early days, I remember you, and I remember a few people from all of the years. You know, we've worked with 100,000 young people at the Roundhouse, and some of them have had a really big impact on me, and you're definitely one of them, partly because we've stayed in touch over all these years. But I suppose the lens by which we see quite a lot of your work is through grief, loss, and loneliness. But you have done this through, I suppose, through humour, but juxtaposed with these kind of moments of heart-squeezing, very, very tear-jerking moments. And I remember coming to see your show Good Grief at the Roundhouse. I don't know if it was the first place where you developed it.
Yeah, it was.
I remember walking in and seeing a coffin full of sweets. There might have been some salty snacks in there as well. And I kind of went, what's there a coffin doing in the studio theatre full of sweets? What was that all about then? It's having another moment, isn't it, this summer at the Roundhouse?
Yeah, it's sort of doing, well, I think it's going to be the kind of final London show of it. And it did fully begin its life at the Roundhouse in 2014. It's when I first started making it. I started filming stuff around Father's Day 2014. And it was a kind of, always supposed to be a show that I wrote with my nan about her experience of losing a child at 80. And my experience of losing a parent and being 15 and the weird symmetry in that, and how it's sort of, you know, the wrong way around for people. So people are kind of very weird and awkward with you. But yeah, I think I remember I first did it in the studio theatre space, and, you know, like, a coffin full of sweets to me is sort of, it's like, how do you turn something quite scary into something that's like silly and funny, and for me, I just used the coffin to for people to get like it was supposed to be full of kind of my favourite bereavement comfort food. That was supposed to be the idea. Now I'm thinking about it, Marcus. I copied the idea of someone else. I went to an event with Cecilia, and the guy who lent me the coffin had run out of table space, and instead of putting stuff, he just started putting like snacks in the coffin. I remember being like, that's such a funny visual and such a funny, for me, like, metaphor for grief and bereavement comfort eating, that I was like, that should be the main set piece of the show. Excited because that show really was my first sort of kind of introduction into being a sort of proper artist, proper performer. So yeah, it's exciting, but definitely the roots of it all are at the Roundhouse, so it's nice to sort of end it there.
It's a full circle moment, I suppose, and I'll definitely be coming back.
You'll be in I'll put you in the VIP seat, Marcus.
Oh yeah, that's the Roundhouse, a very democratic space. It'll be probably near the toilet somewhere, but it's not the first show you've done in the main space. Last year in the Roundhouse 360 Festival, you did a show called Show Hole. Show Hole or Show Hole.
It's whatever you want it to be, Marcus, quite honestly.
I remember looking up and you were dancing away with Self-Esteem and many other people, kind of the A-list, and it was great to look up there and you were the driving force behind it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that was like sort of the first thing I'd ever sort of done in that space, and it was really, really fun. It's sort of like, how do you make a cabaret night / comedy night / club night all in one? And I think we managed to do it, which was really fun. And yeah, we had Patrick Wolf come and perform. We had Self-Esteem. We had Lolly Adefope DJing, James Acaster DJed. It was like comedians DJing and then performers doing weird cabaret turns. It was, yeah, it was really fun. But weirdly, in a way, though, I don't see that as my first show in the main space, because that sort of felt more like I was curating it. Whereas this, doing Good Grief there, I think there's something different. There's a weird like modal shift when you're like performing something or presenting something, if that makes sense. Like there's a weird, it sort of takes like two different parts. I never ever get anxious about presenting anything, which is really strange. So if you could say you're going to present this award in front of how many people to Elton John, I'd be like, yeah, I would not be nervous at all. Whereas you could be like, you're going to perform to 12 people in a room. And my like anxiety would start probably about 5 hours before the performance began and sort of slowly creep up. So I am nervous for the 14th of August because it'll be the start. It'll be the kickoff. It's the first date of the tour. It's the biggest space I've ever performed in.
And how do you counter your nervousness about it on the day, the 5 hours before? Are you walking up and down? Are you standing on one leg? What's your ritual?
I'm sort of a nightmare, I would say. Ask everyone for reassurance all the time. I actually really like to just read through the show again and again and again and again. I think a big part of my nervousness is that my memory recall is really bad. Of lines. So it takes me ages to learn lines. It takes me ages to remember what I've got to say and hit the mark. What I really love about that show, about Good Grief, is that because it was made by a 20, 21 year old, it's very DIY, cut and paste. It's not a really slick theatrical performance. It's a genuine, like, performance maker's first show.
Have you developed it since, though? Have you re-edited it, reworked it? And
not overly, not any of the sort of visual or technical elements. I want it to feel like, you know, it's made by somebody of that age, because what an interesting, like, what a fascinating age to be, 2021. Like, I kind of want to preserve it as much as possible. There's like a new introduction that I do that's an updated thing. There's a slightly new ending, but the actual crux of the show, even to like where I'm stood on stage at what time, is pretty much exactly the same as I did it in 2014, 2015. Yeah, I toured that show up until 2016 as well. So I did a good 3 years of performing it. And then that really was the sort of seedling that gave birth to Big Boys in a way. And I definitely feel, I don't know, I'm sort of most proud of it. I'm more proud of that first show than anything else. Because I just think most artists or performers or writers, the first thing you do is the thing that you've spent your whole life leading up to, in a way. It's the thing that all of your like first ideas and creative energy and thirst and excitement and anticipation, and it really is your like first time expressing all of that. And I do just think it makes you infinitely more interesting. It's why, like, I think a big part of what I want to do in my career post Big Boys is like work with a lot of younger writers and artists and comedians and performers, because there's something about that. And you'll know this because you know, you've been the head of the Roundhouse for so long. There's something about someone's first foray into it all, the energy and the excitement and the like catharsis of it all. I'll never fully experience that again. You know, there are certain things I want to do in my life for the first time, but it'll never quite be the same.
Well, I think there's something in that, which is, it's not that necessarily young performers want to. They may have a great fear. It's that they need to. They need to get something off their chest. And it's like youth orchestras and stuff like that. There's something like they're sitting so far on the edge of the chair. What they usually do is they levitate off the chair. And I've seen you do that, and I've seen other young performers do that. It's absolutely extraordinary. Your story a minute ago is saying you're a nightmare. And I don't believe that for a second. A friend of mine used to work at the Albert Hall. Princess Diana was there, and she's giving an award. And their job was to look after Princess Diana. And they were in a dressing room or somewhere in the royal suite or something. And Lady Diana turned to this friend of mine and just went, you know, I got this dress and, you know, and this kind of like, how do I look? Am I looking all right? Am I sounding all right? You know, and my friend just looked at her and went, you're the most beautiful thing I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. I mean, everyone gets nervous.
Yes.
Pure panic moments.
But, and I suppose when we get over those, it's the moment where we've learned something and then we know that we can do it again. And then you can do it again, and you can do it again. But, you know, getting that energy up and building it up and building it up, getting the adrenaline going, you have to have some kind of let out is going on stage.
If it starts feeling like mundane, then it's either because you've lost your love for it, or I think sometimes people can get so sort of used to it that they feel they're sort of entitled to an audience. And I never ever feel like that. I always feel really chuffed and honored when people have gone, yeah, I'm going to come and see you, because it's weird. I feel like that differently to how I would feel about like Big Boys in a way. I don't know why that is. That's an interesting thing. So I the idea of people kind of choosing to come and see me live really touches me in a different way to like the ratings of Big Boys. I sort of don't really care, in the sense of I can't control it. There's nothing I can do about it. So like Big Boys, you're on a channel. You can't control if people are tuning in. You can't control whether they just watch one episode or all 18 episodes. You can't control their engagement. Whereas when someone comes and buys a ticket that has a start time and an end time, and they're locked in a room for 70 minutes with you, that just is like, I feel so much more grateful for that in a weird way. I don't know why.
There's an instant reaction, a back and forward as well. You see the whites of their eyes. I see you as a natural communicator. You're really communicative. You can get your message across. You can be extremely funny and heartrending at the same moment. You've got me in tears in Big Boys. You made me laugh out loud when I was watching the TV, and you've done that in shows. Did you ever wish that you were acting the character, your character, in Big Boys? I know you're in it sometimes.
There was definitely a bit at the start where I remember being like, oh God, should I have acted this? And I sort of did put myself forward, but you know, I'm not a trained actor really. And I do think it's a different sort of skill set, if that makes sense. I sometimes think that Big Boys would have been completely different if I was acting in it, because I don't know how much I would want to act my dad passing away. Yeah. I don't know how much... I think I would have made my character a bit more 2D, because I definitely would love to be an actor and love to be a performer, but I think I know the sort of characters that I could play, and they're not Jack in Big Boys in a weird way, even though he's partially based on my life. Like, if there was any character I'd want to play in Big Boys, it would be Cousin Shannon. And there's a sort of flip side of me, and also I think would be the part I would probably play the best. Whereas sometimes if you're writing something and you know that it's like a real inquiry into the truth or an emotional truth, even though Big Boys is, you know, semi-autobiographical and it's quite fictional in lots of areas. Like, a lot of it is just kind of made up because it's a TV show. There's still an emotional truth that I think for me, as the show went on, I felt more and more relieved that I wasn't having to carry that emotional burden performatively as well as creatively and as a writer. And I think, yeah, Dylan also does a really beautiful job of portraying Jack and all the sort of anxious neuroses of him. And John Poynting does a really beautiful job of kind of carrying us through into a character who perhaps we haven't really seen on TV be depicted in that kind of 3D way before. And the two of them together, just interestingly, it sort of becomes more of a vessel for me to write something more true. And I think when I look back on that, I feel quite grateful for it now. Definitely at the time I was like, I should act in this, I should be. But now I'm like, okay, you know, I might not have got those two writer BAFTAs.
Can you tell me, if that moment when you're going to tell your, or Jack is going to tell his mum in the show, in Big Boys, that he's gay, I was in floods of tears at that moment. And is that true?
It's not really true, no. And everyone's always so disappointed when I say that's not really how it went down.
Can you lie to me a bit?
Well, do you know, there's elements of truth to it. And I think when you're writing TV, you try to find devices or story ideas or plot ideas that then help you tell an emotional truth in a different way. So it's definitely not, you know, a lot of the sentiments and a lot of every single line of dialogue in that scene that Jack is saying to his mum is less about coming out as gay and more about not being able to tell his dad something new about himself. And I think that's where, like, I think that's the secret sauce in the scene that nobody knows. So people will be like, oh, it's the coming out scene. Oh, it's the coming out scene. Oh, it's the coming out scene. But I'm like, yeah, but it's actually sort of it's somebody saying, oh, there's this thing about me that I now can't tell someone I love. And that to me is what that whole thing is about, more than a thing about sort of sexuality or acceptance. But it is also that as well. And I think that's my favourite thing about writing, is that you sometimes sneak something else in. And I do think there's a lot of Big Boys that is about sort of deceiving the audience into thinking something is happening and then something else happens. And it's like, I once got a really amazing bit of advice when I was first doing Good Grief from a theatre director called Vicky Jones, who directed Fleabag, and she is so smart and fun and kind and silly, and like, just, she's got a lovely energy about her. And she was just like, the best thing you can do is subvert people's expectations. The best thing you can do is when somebody's watching something and they think it's going to go away, because every time we all as audiences, we all as viewers, we all think we know where something's going to go. And if you can just jag it at the end or take someone somewhere they weren't realizing that they were going, and then take them to somewhere that actually feels more resonant and more truthful and more kind of connective, then I think that's the sign of great writing. And that's been 10 years of honing that, and experimenting and failing and making mistakes and doing some projects that did well and some projects that did less well. Like, that takes time and focus. But I do think that piece of advice was like the best piece of advice I ever got, because that is sort of what I hope all my work can do.
Well, it certainly does. It takes really challenging issues, but also makes people see them through the lens of humour. And I'd say that you are a great writer, Jack. You know, and I think the world has said you are.
I'm not the best writer by any stretch, by the way. I'm quite a lazy writer at
times. But that's even more lovely that you said that, because, you know, winning two BAFTAs is huge, and having these massive hit runs on Channel 4, but also in your playwriting skills and performance skills is great. But what does a day look like for Jack Rook? Do you kind of get up at 6 and write for 4 hours and then go for a cold swim? Or do you eat, a Pret sandwich for lunch and 6 croissants and then think about it for 4 hours? Is there an average day, or is it every day a different day?
I would say every day is a different day. However, as a writer, I start writing... If I'm in London, it's very different. But if I'm at home and I'm in London, I won't start writing anything until about 9:30 at night. No. It's when everyone's gone to bed. It's where it's just me and my laptop. I put on some music.
Oh, you have music. What do you listen to?
Either songs that are like an emotional drive to a scene, or songs that I think I would want to use on the soundtrack of whatever I'm writing. Or I'll listen to a lot of like instrumental electronic stuff. A lot of John Hopkins. He's very good to write to.
Yeah, well, Imogen Heap was talking about John Hopkins the other day.
He's the best. And so she. Probably have listened to a bit of Imogen Heap before. Probably listened to a bit of Headlock or Speeding Cars, maybe. But yeah, I think that's my like prime time. However, because I am a writer and I reserve the right to become a pretentious monster, I have recently discovered that I do my best writing in Paris. And when I'm in Paris, I can write in the daytimes. And I think it's because I don't know anyone there and I can't understand what anyone's saying, so I don't get easily distracted.
So, Jack, if, you know, lots of stuff going on, you have huge numbers of projects and things going around your brain, lots of ideas, you're listening, you're a very curious person, you love to know what's going on in lots of different places. Actually, if you close your eyes and just let yourself be, what happens?
Ooh, I mean, I'm doing it right now. I definitely have realised, and in a quite classic cliche case of the comedian, that I'm an extroverted introvert. So, like, I can be quite forward-facing and quite, you know, and perform and do stuff. But I actually I've recently realised how much I actually do quite like spending time by myself. It was something that I always used to really hate. Whereas now, I've sort of learned to sort of shut my eyes and, like, just sort of kind of hear myself or have a chat with myself about stuff and try and work things out in my brain quite a lot. Actually, I get loads of ideas when I just do that. When I'm just by myself and it's just calm and I just really think, I'm like, oh, that's a good idea, that's a good idea, that's a good idea. And then I always forget to write them down. And then 2 days later, I'll be like, what was that good idea I had? And I'll be like, it's gone. I've forgotten it. I've got to hope it comes back to me in another way, through some other message or another trigger or something. But yeah, I think I have a big inner monologue with myself. I'm sort of talking, we're talking to each other, me and my brain, often in a strange way.
I am now going to come to the quick fire round. What was your first job?
I worked at the Students Union reception of my university.
Did you enjoy it?
No, because it was boring. Yes, because I would give out people's student cards, their NUS extra cards, to get discounts. And if somebody had been horrible to me that week, then I would pretend that theirs hadn't arrived in the post yet. I also would give out condoms, which I suppose is good for everyone's health.
Yes, absolutely. And encouragement for those who thought that might not happen as well. Last time you laughed until you cried. When was the last time?
me and my friend Dave watched a really bad film at my house, and it was so bad. I won't name the film, but...
No, we want the film. We need the film.
No, I can't name it because it was like a small independent film, but it was so awful. We were like screaming with laughter, howling just at how bad this film was. But it sadly was made by an independent director writer, and I'm not going to name them.
No, we'll go no further. In our house, it's always arguments about my wife wants to watch a kind of documentary about something. And then my youngest, who's studying some ancient history stuff at A-level, said, oh, there's a really fantastic documentary we could watch about ancient Rome. And she goes, oh, great. What's it called? And he said, Gladiator.
Yeah, great.
Okay. Who do you have a favourite musician at the moment? Singer-songwriter or somebody you could recommend, or somebody who's just there with you all the time?
I recently went to see Rose Grey at Coco, who is a pop star in the making. She's great, and she was really, really fun and amazing live, and had brilliant, brilliant vocals.
Ah, someone to everyone to look out for. Last time your breath was taken away.
I thought you were going to say last time your breath was smelly.
Yeah, I definitely asked that in an interview.
Last time your breath was smelly and you were in a room full of people.
It's definitely that one, in a lift. No, I love that phrase, you know, you don't measure your life by the number of breaths you take, but by the number of times your breath is taken away. The last time you will go, I'll remember that forever.
I think that it was, kind of quite honestly, winning the BAFTA again. To be entirely, because I really was not expecting it. I'd really kind of resigned myself to going, I've won this one before, and that was lovely, and you know what a great strike of luck. And then you win a second time. No one sort of won it consecutively before, so to win it again, I genuinely was like, oh, and I had no clue what I was going to say.
But that video of you. Your winning speech has just gone completely viral. People were cheering. You know, you mentioning the Roundhouse and Soho Theatre, which was absolutely brilliant of you, and thank you. So if you were Prime Minister for one day, actually, Jack, I know you're absolutely brilliant, so I'm going to give you a month. What would you do for young people and the arts and creativity, maybe mental health in there as well?
I think I would really get a campaign of the best artists that we know, and I'd shoot some films with them about the other stuff they do, like the hugely famous singer-songwriter that just loves to like doodle in a book because that's cathartic, or likes to go cycle around and listen to music, or likes to do pottery, or likes to do it. Like I think there's something about expression and creativity that is so much more accessible than we realize. And I think we live in a really strange time now of constantly building our own profiles and identities and brands and whatnot. And I think that applies to both artists and non-artists. And sometimes I actually think like even somebody eats a meal in a fun way, I'm like, that's creative. Even somebody like drawing on a bus ticket, or you know, when it's been raining and like doing a little message on, like some of the best art I've ever seen is on like a filthy car. And I think like encouraging very, very small acts of creativity leads to bigger ones. I don't necessarily always think big acts of creativity lead to loads of smaller ones. I think it's the other way around. And I think the more you can encourage people to take those first few steps into something, or to see the benefits in something creative being cathartic, or when you're being creative, finding something non-creative that is cathartic as well. Like that to me is something that I want more young people to engage with, because I do think we live in a real perfectionist world. We live in a world of real rewarded excellence, and I am maybe slightly proud of the fact that like you know, if I'm going to win those two BAFTAs, then I'm going to do my show from 2014 as scrappy and shoddily and as cut and paste and DIY as it was then, because that leads to that. You don't have to come in the slickest. And often, you know, the comedians and performers I know who have put a lot of money or have had a lot of money to be able to invest in themselves, yes, they might make something slicker, but being slick doesn't always mean you're telling the most brilliant story. Like, you still can be, but it doesn't necessarily mean that, like, people will connect with anything as long as those, like, baseline simple principles are there.
It's all about the story, and we're talking about a story of a young man who came to the Roundhouse and wrote a poem about a lasagna and ended up, so far, winning two BAFTAs. But if I could ask you, what does the Roundhouse mean to you?
I think it's home. It's like everything that we have been speaking about recently about how you get young people to engage. It is for them to feel seen and safe and represented. And to me, that is the Roundhouse. It's home. It's somewhere I don't feel judgment. It's somewhere where things are really possible. Nothing's impossible. It's a place that, like, feels really community orientated. It's a place that's exciting because it also does have that, like, commercial angle where you might see Little Mix there. I've seen Lady Gaga at the Roundhouse before. The fact that you can then go and see brand new artists or people making their first work, that to me is like the magic of a building like that. And I would also say, Marcus, if I'm allowed to, that I do think that that has been really carefully and lovingly crafted by you for decades now. And you do deserve to sort of put your feet up or in a foot spa or go and just get a massage on a beach somewhere and do nothing. Because I do think you have built a home for many, many people. And that's so, what a, like, lovely legacy. That's what all arts institutions should hope to become. And home for me, like, is somewhere where you can be challenged and pushed and experiment and fail and muck up and have rows, have fallouts, have like make up again, have dinner, be friends, be, you know, you can live everything at home. And I think I have, like, you know, I've had, like, a real kind of creative upbringing there.
But your journey is continuing, I hope, for many decades to come. And your kind words, thank you. And I feel obviously the same about the Roundhouse as you do. It's home where I've messed up and learned and risked and won. It's everything, you know. It's just fantastic for me. And just as I am about to leave, it also is the beginning of a journey for both of us, because we're both commissioners on this Young Creatives Commission working with the Centre for Young Lives. Why did you agree to take part in this Young Creatives Commission?
For me, the main intention is that I feel very upset that the landscape in which I first made my work, which was one of amazing resources like Ideas Tap, or like I just said earlier on when I met Rob DeBank, was through a BBC Switch scheme. Like, there was the BFI Young Audiences Content Fund that funded 50% of Big Boys Getting Made, and it was an amazing fund to try and get young people watching TV, to get young people engaging in the televisual arts with programs that speak to them about their experiences. And then the week the Big Boys came out, the fund got cut from the government. That I just sort of constantly feel like every bit of funding or everything that has actually been quite a sort of life-changing bit of, making something a reality has kind of been cut just as I've benefited from it. And I feel concerned about the landscape of the arts right now for young people. I feel concerned that the Edinburgh Fringe has cut the Keep It Fringe Fund by 93%, because the Edinburgh Fringe is so expensive and that needs reform in its own way. But it's also an incredibly important integral cog in the kind of creative live performance world. I feel sad that so many state schools are sort of discouraging, or in the worst case scenario, cutting drama and music and visual arts from their syllabuses. And I also think I feel concerned that we have not had stable government in years. And by stable government, I suppose I mean like we've had so many changes and shifts continually that I just fear that we have no one really who wants to try to sort of, we've lost quite a lot, and I don't see anyone trying to come in to rectify. And I suppose I'm quite fearful that we could have a government that has got quite extreme views. And when you have a government that maybe has more extreme views, that does tend to put curbs on creative freedom and creative license. And, you know, artists are, whether we like it or not sometimes, are sort of designed to be provoking institutions. They are designed to be the voice of dissent. And, you know, I think that we need to always cultivate that, because it even if I don't always agree with some artists on some points, I'm glad that there's a breadth of that. I'm glad that there's a scale of that. And we need young people to become our next generation of artists. We can't continuously create blocks and, harder roots in. We need to create more roots in. So that's why I want it to become part of the commission. I think it's becoming more and more important now than ever before.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I totally agree with you. So great stuff to do together. So, Jack, Big Boys is completed. Are you allowed to say anything about what you're working on next? I mean, I imagine the phone has been ringing quite a lot.
Yeah, there's some lovely opportunities out there, which has been really fun. I just spent the last year writing on some other people's shows. That was really fun. I wrote on an amazing adaptation of The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole. That's been show ran by David Nichols, who's one of the kindest, loveliest writers in Britain, and a really fun HBO comedy. That's been fun. So yeah, I've been writing on other people's stuff, and I've got a couple of pilots that I'm working on. And then obviously I'm doing a tour.
And we look forward to welcoming you back to the Roundhouse, yeah, but into the main space with your own work. And that is going to be a joy to behold. And I'm going to be there. It's my first event I'm going to come back to. Jack, I've greatly admired you since when I first met you. And it's been an honour to be a friend with you, but also to watch your career grow. And you're even more of the humble person. You look at surprise that you win these awards and things, but to the rest of us, it's no surprise at all. Thank you so much for making space with me today. You never know, but this might be the end of my podcasting career, because this is the last one in my series of six, and I can't be happier that I've done it with you.
Well, neither can I. I'm very chuffed to be to be your closing act. You know, on behalf of myself and all the people who have built creative careers that started at the Roundhouse, we thank you too.
Thank you very much. And see you on the 14th.
See you on the 14th of August.
Fantastic. Great stuff.